Hello, folks. Welcome to First Thursday, the monthly podcast of the Labor Relations Information System. My name is Will Aitchison. I'll be your host for the next 45 minutes or so as we go through recent developments in the public safety workplace. And boy, is our plate set full this month. There's just a surfeit of cases out there that I would love to talk about. I may not get beyond two of them, I've got to warn you. There are two cases that have popped up, one from Florida, one from Illinois, that get at complicated relationships between different legal theories. The Florida case involves the relationship between the Miranda rule and the Garrity rule. And the Illinois case, completely different in nature, involves the relationship between the Americans with Disabilities Act and HIPAA, you know, in the context of a fitness for duty evaluation and what the Cook County Sheriff's Department in Illinois refers to as HIPAA forms. Both of these issues, the Miranda-Garrity issue and the HIPAA-ADA issue, have caused employers a great deal of consternation over the years as to how the different legal theories relate to each other. What are an employer's obligations in these settings? And how is it possible, for example, in the fitness for duty context, how is it possible that an employer's use of a federally approved HIPAA form could conceivably violate the Americans with Disabilities Act? Well, these two cases help us navigate those very rocky shoals. Let's start in Florida. And I'm going to talk to you quite a bit about the facts of this case in Florida because these Miranda and Garrity cases are all very factually dependent. They come down to who said what to whom, under what circumstances, and they tend to be very, very factually intensive and determined cases. So this case comes out of an investigation into corruption in the Miami-Dade Police Department in 2016. There were allegations of internal corruption within the department's narcotics bureau, and the department cranked up a criminal investigation. There is apparently a criminal conspiracy section of the department's professional compliance bureau, and that section orchestrated a clandestine sting operation. What did they do? They rented a motel room and designated a undercover police officer from Orlando, many miles away, to pose as a drug peddler. The undercover officer was given $3,113 in pocket cash. Don't you just wonder sometimes where these amounts come from? $3,113. $13. At any rate, he was also given an altered ID card, a couple of bags that contained illegal narcotics, and also $14,314 in currency. The officers marked the money with fluorescent powder, and they recorded, of course, the serial numbers on each of the banknotes. And then one evening, a call came in. And the call came in to Edwin Diaz, who is the partner of the officer who is the subject of this case. And that officer is Armando Sakaris. Sakaris is a 10-year veteran of the department. He was a member of the Narcotics Bureau. And on the evening in question, Diaz gets a tip from a confidential informant regarding a male subject selling narcotics out of the motel room. Sakaris and his squad responded to the location, and they arrested the undercover officer outside of the motel room. There was a search done, a search incident to an arrest, so it didn't need a warrant. The search incident to the arrest yielded a wallet that contained both cash and narcotics. Diaz then gets a search warrant, and the two bags that contain currency and narcotics were recovered from inside the motel room, and all of the evidence was tagged and designated for impoundment. Sakaris was in charge of the inventorying and impounding of the narcotics and the currency. He and Diaz drove to the Property and Evidence Bureau of the department to impound the property. There were two sergeants who were waiting for him. After Sakaris and Diaz left, the sergeants discovered that $1,300 of the seized currency was missing. So as Sakaris is driving away, a detective, his name is David Colon, detained Sakaris. Colon was a plainclothes officer. He was driving an undercover police vehicle, but he had a police badge that was prominently displayed around his neck, and he pulled Sakaris over by using his emergency lights on his undercover vehicle. Colon drew his firearm, ordered Sakaris out of the car at gunpoint, and identified himself as an IA officer. He then patted down Sakaris, relieved Sakaris of his duty weapon, and placed Sakaris in the back seat of his undercover police vehicle. So there's every indication right now, of course, that Sakaris is completely in custody for Miranda purposes, right? A backup officer arrives, handcuffs Sakaris. The officer sees Sakaris' automobile. They get a warrant, and they find the missing $1,300 inside of a compartment located in Sakaris' automobile. Sakaris is then transferred in the back of the marked police car to the department's Professional Compliance Bureau. He's scanned with ultraviolet light to determine the absence or presence of the fluorescent powder. For a while, he's put in the cafeteria, but then he's moved to Colon's office. While he's in Colon's office, he becomes ill. Colon walks him to the bathroom where Sakaris vomits. Sakaris then returns to Colon's office where he again vomited, and Colon gives Sakaris access to a telephone. Now, here comes the really important stuff in terms of Miranda and Garrity. Colon gives Sakaris his Miranda rights, both orally and through a standard written Miranda waiver form, which Sakaris signs and initials. Sakaris then makes an initial verbal statement. Think of that as statement number one. 4 hours later, he submits to a recorded formal interview. Think of the recorded formal interview as statement number two. During the interview, Sakaris, unprompted, stated that he had inadvertently neglected to impound some of the currency. The investigators then turn off the recording device. Don't start me on that, okay? They turn off the recording device. 40 minutes later, Sakaris gives his third and final statement to the investigators. In this statement, he said, "I did it because I was experiencing financial difficulties and I needed the money." Sakaris is criminally charged with grand theft, and he moved to suppress all three of his statements, contending that they were obtained in violation of Garrity. Trial court granted suppression of all three statements on the theory that Sakaris reasonably believed he was compelled to give all three statements under threat of potential job loss. And that, of course, is the test in Garrity, right? Does the employee reasonably believe? So you need both a subjective belief, and that subjective belief has to be reasonable. Does the employee reasonably believe, when they're giving a statement, that if they don't give the statement, they could be fired? And the trial court concludes that Sakaris reasonably believed that with respect to all three statements. Florida Court of Appeals, you know, the state, of course, appeals the suppression order. Florida Court of Appeals says, not so fast. The court doesn't have any problem with the notion that the third statement, the one that is the most incriminating of the statements, the one where he says, yeah, I stole it because I was experiencing financial difficulties, the court doesn't have any problem with the third statement being a protected Garrity statement. Why? Between the second and third statements, the interrogating officers told Sakaris, and I'm quoting, We have to make this look like an isolated incident if you want to try to maintain your position in narcotics. Well, that, said both the trial court and the Court of Appeals, that is a threat of removal from office, and that triggers Garrity, and therefore that statement has to be suppressed. But as far as the Court of Appeals is concerned, that doesn't say anything about the first two statements. The first two statements, the court says, the trial court got wrong. Those were voluntary statements. Why were they voluntary statements? Well, I'm going to read you about three, four lines out of the court's opinion and I think it's important, even though I don't normally read this much of a court's opinion, it's important for you to hear what the court's analysis is here. The court says it's undisputed that prior to Sakaris's first and second statements, the investigators did not threaten Sakaris with adverse employment consequences or any other impermissible penalty. Sakaris was administered Miranda warnings and explicitly waived his rights. Furthermore, now the court's going to dive in with both feet here, the dissimilarity between Sakaris' prior internal affairs investigations, he'd been the subject of prior IAs, and the detention on the evening of the theft quells the reasonableness of any finding that Sakaris was immersed in a mere administrative proceeding and thus compelled to confess under a postulated penalty of termination. Sakaris conceded that as a 10-year police veteran, he had performed legions of arrests and administered Miranda warnings on approximately 50 occasions. As the subject of four prior IA investigations, he was well-versed in the administrative process, and he appeared on those occasions on his own volition at a familiar precinct and was allowed uninhibited interaction with a police union representative. That's not what happens here, said the court. Here, he was arrested, he was handcuffed, he was transported in the back of a patrol car, he was given Miranda warnings, he signed Miranda warnings. This is a 10-year police officer, says the court. There is no mistake, can be no reasonable mistake in his mind as to whether or not his statements were voluntary or whether this was a criminal or administrative investigation. So the court sends the case back down to the trial court for a trial with the third statement suppressed. So what did the employer do wrong here? Well, it got everything right up to those off-the-record statements by the investigators to Sakaris that, look, if you give us your statements, you give us your account, we will have to make this look like an isolated incident if you try to maintain your position in narcotics. It was the focus on the potential job loss that caused the employer to lose the suppression motion, the state actually, to lose the suppression motion on the third statement. If that statement had not been made, that statement meaning the statement by the investigators, I don't have any doubt but that the third statement would be considered voluntary as well as the first two statements. At any rate, just in terms of a practice tip, if you are an employer, it is a terrible, terrible idea if you're investigating someone and you think there's criminal ramifications to the investigation, it is a terrible idea to start the process by giving Miranda warnings and then moving into Garrity warnings. When you do that, you are confusing everybody, the employee, and certainly the courts, as to whether or not the moment you give the Garrity warning, everything is off limits, because it's now become a compelled statement. Either give Miranda or Garrity. Don't give both. Now let's take a look at that HIPAA case that comes out of Cook County. Cook County, by the way, is Chicago's county, Cook County, Illinois. So what's going on in this case? This case that involves a correctional officer by the name of John Nawara. Nawara's been employed for quite some time with the Cook County Sheriff's Office. From 2002 to 2007, he was on a Special Operations Response Team, the acronym SORT. It's kind of the equivalent of a SWAT team in the Cook County Jail. Members of SORT supported a candidate who challenged Sheriff Tom Dart in a primary election in 2006. Dart won, and he disbanded SORT. 21 members of SORT, including Nawara, then successfully sued the county and Dart. But that's all in the past. That's many, many years ago. What I want to focus on is what was happening in late 2016. By late 2016, Nawara was assigned to the basement of a hospital to monitor detainees. I'm sure that's completely unrelated to Nawara successfully suing the department and Dart about 10 years before. Yeah, right. In any case, there's a fight between inmates. Nawara is one of the people who responds to it. And after the dust settles on the fight, there's a disagreement between Nawara and one of his supervisors. And she, according to Nawara, she's very condemnatory of him in the presence of others. She raises her voice. She uses epithets to describe him and ends up poking him in the chest many times. The department transfers Nawara. He transfers him out of the basement, and he responds with a formal complaint that the supervisor had assaulted and harassed him. Now things ramp up, as they sometimes do, and they seem to ramp up periodically in Nawara's career with the department. The department summons Nawara to a meeting, and representatives of the department tell him, you're going to have to go through a fitness for duty evaluation. And the concern is that his behavior either during in breaking up the fight or in the interaction with the supervisor justifies a fitness for duty evaluation. The department's representatives present him with two HIPAA release forms. That's the general description of them that's given in the court's opinion. These release forms were blank. Nawara didn't sign the form and instead gets an attorney. So what do the forms say? One of them says, and I'm going to quote here, and the words of these are very, very important. I, fill in the blank, authorize the independent medical or exam or fitness for duty exam physician to disclose protected health information about me as described in this authorization. So this is releasing whoever the doctor is who's going to do the fitness for duty evaluation to release the information, any medical information, to whoever is listed in the form. So what does the form say about the whoever and the whatever? Well, the whatever is that the release applies to, quote, all medical records and information that relate to my fitness for duty exam. And who is the whoever? It is a disability case manager for Cook County. They apparently have a third-party contract with an outfit known as Corvell Corporation, but it doesn't matter. You can't contract away your HIPAA or ADA responsibilities if you are an employer. The form also states, to make it clear, if it wasn't already clear, that the employee understands, quote, that the information disclosed pursuant to this authorization may no longer be protected by the federal health privacy rule and may be subject to redisclosure by the recipient. So what the form is saying is, doctor, you can give this information to the disability case manager for Cook County, who can give it to anybody that they want. That's essentially what that form says. The second form is broader, believe it or not. This form gives the employee three options, and this is what's known as a disclosure form. So the first form is the release or authorization form. The second form is the disclosure form. This form gives the employee three options. Option number one, the employee can describe particular information with respect to specific treatments, conditions, or dates. So the disclosure can apply only to whatever either conditions or treatment or dates the employee is specifying. That's option number one. What's behind door number two? Door number two says you can disclose all healthcare information. And door number three says you can disclose something else that will be described, fill in the blank. On the form that's given to NOARA, door number two is checked, pre-checked by the department. He is obligated to permit the release of all healthcare information. Well, NOARA eventually sues. There's a long tail that I'm not going to spend much time on at all. He ends up getting placed on unpaid leave for a period of time. He finally goes through a fitness for duty evaluation. The doctor says he's fit for duty, and he brings a lawsuit, and it is a lawsuit that is an exercise in expansive pleading. The lawyers filing this lawsuit raised just about every claim you can possibly raise in these sorts of situations. There's due process. There's all sorts of stuff. I want to focus on only one, and that is the claim that the department's use of the HIPAA forms violated the Americans with Disabilities Act. Well, how can a HIPAA form violate the ADA? Well, this is something that's not widely understood, so I want to harp on it a little bit. Most employers think that the federal statute that grants employees privacy rights in the workplace is HIPAA. It's not. For almost no public employee does HIPAA provide any privacy protections in the workplace. It certainly, you know, has provisions that forbid the disclosure of medical information by a provider of medical care. But in terms of preventing the employer from inquiring into an employee's medical condition, there's nothing in HIPAA about that. With a very, very modest exception that it might apply to EMTs or paramedics who are actually providing medical care out on the scene. But for the average rank-and-file firefighter, corrections officer, law enforcement officer, HIPAA's not the law you want. The law you want, if you're going to look for privacy protections in the workplace, is the Americans with Disabilities Act. And the ADA has one section, one sentence that provides those privacy rights. What's the sentence say? It says that an employer, and I'm going to quote, shall not require a medical examination, parenthetically, a fitness for duty evaluation is a medical examination, right? Okay. An employer shall not require a medical examination and shall not make inquiries of an employee as to whether the employee is an individual with a disability or the nature or severity of the disability unless the examination or inquiry is job-related and consistent with business necessity. All right, let's unpack that sentence. So the ADA gives privacy protections in two areas, medical examinations and inquiries of employees as to the nature or severity of their disability. How sick are you? What's your condition? You know, what's your treatment plan? What's your prognosis? Those are all inquiries into the nature or severity of the disability. So the privacy protections apply in both of those areas, medical exams and inquiries. And the employer can't make them unless it meets two tests. The examination or the inquiry must be, one, job-related, and second, consistent with business necessity. Job-related, I think we all know what that means. The inquiry has to be related to the employee's physical or mental condition and how it impacts their ability to perform the essential functions of the job. That's a broad brush description of what a job-related inquiry is. What about consistent with business necessity? What does it mean? It means necessity. The employer's got to have this information in order for it to provide the basic services that it needs to provide. It's got to have the information. This is not business inclination or business desire. This is business necessity in the ADA. All right, so how does the court take a look at these two HIPAA forms under that ADA standard? And the procedural vehicle, for those of you who keep track of these things, is the county files a motion to dismiss the ADA lawsuit. Here's how the court analyzes the issue. It says, first of all, the forms themselves, the HIPAA authorization form and the release, same document, and the scope of the HIPAA authorization forms, those forms are not examinations in and of themselves. The examination here is the fitness for duty evaluation. However, says the court, the HIPAA forms are part of the department's inquiry into Nawara's fitness for duty, and therefore the forms fall within the scope of the ADA. And what does that mean? That means that the forms are going to have to be job-related and consistent with business necessity, and the scope of the release is going to have to be job-related and consistent with business necessity. So how does the court analyze this? And let me read you a few sentences from the court's opinion. The department argues that the medical releases need not have been job-related and consistent with business necessity because the fitness for duty evaluation for which they were requested was itself job-related. The fact that the fitness for duty evaluation was job-related, however, does not make an inquiry into Nawara's entire medical past job-related, nor does it cabin the release form to fitness for duty-related medical records. All right. First of all, the court's use of the word cabin. Don't you just love it when people use words unusually and very correctly? So cabin in this context, meaning it doesn't confine the release form to fitness for duty medical records. So what's the court saying here? The court is saying that, look, the fact that you may have had a reason, and the court doesn't decide in this opinion whether or not the reason for the fitness for duty evaluation was in fact job-related and consistent with business necessity. The court says the fact that you may have had such a reason that was job-related and consistent with business necessity doesn't allow you carte blanche access to all of the employee's medical records and medical past. Instead, the information that you are gathering in the fitness for duty evaluation and the information that can be released by the evaluator back to the employer, that can only be information that in and of itself is job-related and consistent with business necessity. So here's the tagline on the court's opinion that ties the knot on this whole thing. The release form appears to seek all healthcare information from any medical provider without specifying any particular time frame or medical condition about which the county sought information. This would effectively permit the county access to a wealth of information about Nawara unrelated to his fitness for duty. So this is a lesson that, unfortunately, some employer in this country is going to have to learn this month and next month and the month after that, because these cases come down with a fair amount of regularity. Fitness for duty evaluations have to be specific. They have to be specific to whatever the reasons are that the employer doubts the employee's fitness for duty. And it just drives me crazy sometimes to see reports from third-party evaluators, whether they're psychologists or whether they're physicians, although I have to say it's hard to pick between the two as to who's the worst offender. It drives me crazy to see these reports that start with the employee's earliest years in life and their toilet training habits all the way up to their present medical conditions, containing all sorts of medical information or psychological information that is completely unrelated to the reason the employee has been sent to the fitness for duty evaluation in the first place. And caution to employers in this area: make sure that the doctors that you are contracting with understand these rules, because when you sign a contract with a doctor to do, or a clinic or whatever, to do all of your fitness for duty evaluations, that doesn't absolve you from liability under the Americans with Disabilities Act. You're liable, vicariously liable, for the ADA sins of your contractor. So make sure that your contractors understand these rules. The employers that I've seen that I think have a really good understanding of this not only limit what the fitness for duty evaluation is going to cover with an appropriate cover letter to the physician or to the psychologist, they also make it clear to the physician or psychologist that, you know, we don't want one of these 10-page letters coming back from you detailing everything about the employee's medical or psychological condition. You know what we want to know? We want your evaluation to start off with, it's my judgment that this employee is either fit for duty or not fit for duty. And if the employee is not fit for duty, then we want to know whether or not there are any reasonable accommodations that you could identify, doctor, that would allow you allow the employee to perform the essential functions of the job with those reasonable accommodations. Beyond that, don't send us anything else. If we need more information, if the employee questions the fitness for duty evaluation, then we'll handle that on a case-by-case, instance-by-instance basis. But don't be sending us everything you learn about the employee's condition. Next case up is out of the San Francisco Police Department, and it's just a fascinating case about whether placement of police officers who've been involved in an officer-involved shooting, placement of them on some sort of administrative assignment, whether it's administrative leave or whether it's administrative duties, whether or not that can violate something in an employer's obligations under labor laws. And an arbitrator finds that under some circumstances, in fact, it can. So what's going on in this case? This is a case involving five officers who were involved in 2015 in an officer-involved shooting in which a young man by the name of Mario Woods was killed. To say the least, this became a very publicly debated incident in San Francisco and even beyond the confines of San Francisco. It was front page news in the San Francisco Chronicle, not just for days, but for weeks, months. There still are articles in the Chronicle from time to time about the shooting. There was, of course, intense interest in social media, various communities, the family and friends friends of Mario Woods got very involved. So this is like one of these flashpoint officer-involved shootings. The department transferred the officers, the five officers, to administrative assignments. And the department very quickly cranks up something that it calls a return to duty panel. This is described in the department's rules with some specificity. The panel's a big one. It has a deputy chief, a commander, a captain that oversaw each of the involved officers' units, had someone from an outfit called the Management Control Division. There was a deputy chief of police for investigations and risk management on it, somebody from the behavioral science unit, and the officer in charge of the homicide detail. So this panel convenes. They talk about it, and in the case of the five officers, they recommend unanimously that the five officers be returned to full duty. The chief rejects the panel's recommendation, and he does so because of the very public nature of what was going on in terms of the reaction to this officer-involved shooting. How long did the officers remain in off the street and in these administrative assignments? 2 years and 8 months. What were the assignments? Here's the arbitrator's description of them. These administrative assignments essentially precluded the officers from directly serving the public as police officers. All five were sent to desk and clerical jobs and duties and were not allowed to perform normal law enforcement duties, including going out on the street to patrol, investigate crimes, write police reports, etc., etc. Essentially, they were reduced to doing tasks that the non-sworn employees of the department usually handled. Were the officers harmed? In the judgment of the arbitrator, the officers were harmed. And they were harmed in a variety of different ways. And these are some interesting findings to me, particularly the first one. And that is that the officers lost the experience that was enjoyed by their peers. And that they, because they were in these administrative assignments, didn't get the same advantages that their peers did. What were those advantages? The advantages of being able to, and I'm back to the arbitrator's opinion here, hone their tactical skills on the street, learn the ropes of the judicial system, improve their ability to write reports, and increase their general knowledge of law enforcement issues, including evolving changes within the department through practical experience, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. This is important, says the arbitrator, because in the case of these officers, particularly two of whom were quite younger, gaining this experience actually has an impact on their careers in the future. Also, the arbitrator said, the officers lost the opportunities at specialized assignments. That may have been, those may have been assignments that carried with them premium pay. So there's definitely a loss there, and certainly the loss of experience. So now to the $64,000 question. Is anything wrong? Does this assignment of these officers to administrative duties, does it violate any labor principle? And the arbitrator says, yes, it violates the principle of past practice. The arbitrator says, here we have a very, very long-standing past practice. It is incorporated into the employer's rules, and for the employer to want to effectuate a change in that past practice, it's going to have to negotiate with the union. Now, the city's argument in this case was the past practice isn't binding because the past practice is a management right, concerns a topic that is a management right. And that topic are power is the use of force policies of the department. And in fact, the city's completely right on this. There are California Supreme Court opinions, one in particular involving the city of San Jose, that finds that use of force policies are a management right under California law. But the arbitrator says, look, you know, there's another factor that's very important in this case. Back to his opinion. The association's most persuasive argument in this case is that the chief and the department violated the department's general orders and the past practice by keeping these officers out of patrol. There are two problems with the city's argument. First of all, the past practice. And secondly, there is a classical arbitrary and capricious limitation on the exercise of governmental discretion. And here, for the chief to not follow the unanimous opinion of this return to work panel, that is arbitrary and capricious. So, what remedy does the arbitrator think is appropriate? He punts on the remedy. The arbitrator sends it back to the parties and directs them to meet and confer in an effort to reach an arm's length agreement on those sums. And the arbitrator reserves jurisdiction as to any disputes that may come about. I'm not completely convinced about this arbitrator's analysis of the case. I'm certainly convinced by the harm to the officers. But the arbitrator is essentially saying here that a past practice must be followed by an employer even if the past practice isn't mandatory for bargaining. That seems to me to be a mild extension of the law. But I've got a caveat. San Francisco doesn't bargain under the general state statute in California. That general state statute is known as the Myers-Milius-Brown Act, MMBA. San Francisco has its own city charter, and that charter provides for a bargaining system that actually culminates with binding arbitration, where the MMBA is a meet-and-confer type of bargaining law. And my exposure to the city's bargaining charter is that it deems more to be negotiable than, and certainly in terms of the effects of non-negotiable issues, than would California state law. Arbitrator's opinion isn't quite clear as to whether he's relying on that distinction in upholding the past practice, but what is clear from the arbitrator's opinion is he thought that the decision in this case to move away from the past practice, that it was longstanding and lovingly incorporated in the employer's rule and to keep rules and to keep these officers on these administrative assignments for almost 3 years, that was beyond the pale. All right, that's it for the May 2019 edition of First Thursday. We hope to see you at an upcoming LRIS seminar. The next one we've got by the time this is released is going to be in September of 2019, where we will have our grievances and arbitration seminar. I also want to put a bug in your ear and ask you to give us some comments if you're so inclined. At LRIS, we are thinking of putting together a fitness seminar. And by fitness seminar, I'm talking about emotional and physical fitness. There is much that is swirling around out there about public safety employees and the heightened need to focus on fitness. We have law enforcement officers and firefighters in this country who are dying prematurely after they retire, who are suffering from elevated rates of cancer and heart disease and lung conditions and mental conditions such as PTSD and depression. We have, for example, for police officers, elevated suicide rates. It goes on and on and on. And there are a number of employers around the country, police and fire employers, that are taking a very proactive approach to mental and physical fitness. And we're thinking that we are at the point right now where it would be worth putting together a 2.5-day seminar that focused just on these issues of fitness. Because we're LRIS and we have this legal focus, we'd spend a little bit of time, not a lot, a couple of hours, talking about the law and fitness, and certainly would talk about some of the topics we talked about today, the Americans with Disabilities Act and the Family and Medical Leave Act and things like that. But the biggest part of the seminar, at least as we're envisioning it right now, would be a panel discussion from representatives of management and labor around the country in law enforcement and fire protection agencies who have had successful fitness programs, successful viewed by the metrics not just of the subjective health of officers and firefighters, but also measurable metrics such as a reduction in workers' compensation injuries or a reduction in civil liability lawsuits. So if you're thinking that that might be a seminar that we should be doing, let us know. Let us know why, and let us know what sort of topics you would like us to discuss at such a seminar. Just send your emails to info@LRIS.com. We look forward to it. This is one where I kind of think we have an obligation to put on this sort of seminar. We may not get the attendance we normally get at a seminar. Bluntly, we may end up losing money on the seminar, but I think this is a topic that is important enough that we need to do it. All right. With that, thank you for joining me during this podcast, and look forward to talking to you next month for another First Thursday podcast. This is Will Aitchison signing off.